This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Frame. Mother's Day is almost here. What are you getting her? Something that shows you care. Something that makes her feel loved. Something that won't stress you out. Something like the Skylight Frame. The Skylight Frame is the perfect gift. It's a touchscreen photo frame your whole family can upload photos to, from wherever they are in the world. It's a way to share with her all the moments that matter. It sets up in seconds. You can even make sure that it's already loaded with photos when your mom opens her Mother's Day gift. And her Skylight Frame can hold thousands of the treasured photos you share. It's an easy, heartfelt way for mom to stay connected with those who matter most. It really is the perfect gift. Now, as a special Mother's Day offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com/easy. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightframe.com/easy.
Welcome back to It Old Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, this is not what I sound like normally. You guys, I don't have a voice. I've been sick. I was starting to feel better last week on Friday, and then I just kind of took a turn for the worse, and I haven't had a voice for a couple days. Kind of sucks when your job's a podcaster to lose your voice, but I'm on steroids and hopefully this voice will come back soon. This is my moneymaker, y'all. This is my moneymaker. If you're new, please come back. I usually sound way better than this. I usually have some good shit to say too. I'm going to keep it brief today. Luckily, we have a really great interview, so let's just get the show on the road. But yeah, come back. Because I usually have some nice things to say, and I don't usually sound this fucking annoying. I like to curse too, just so you know. Oh, Lord. So today we are diving deep with Krista St. Germain. She is a master certified life coach. She is a widow. She's a mom. She's a grief expert. She is the host of the podcast, The Widowed Mom Podcast. And she does just that. She helps widowed moms heal and grow. She's all about post-traumatic growth, which I'm all about too. So I'm just going to shut up and just get on with the damn interview because it's really good. And I actually have some good shit to say too about grief that I want to touch upon as soon as I have my voice back. Oh God, you guys, this is so ridiculous. I can't wait to listen back to this shit. So let's just get the show on the road. But first, let's talk about why you need to damn the join shit show. Damn the join shit show, folks. This is my online support community. I bet you really want to join it now, don't you? Sorry. I hope you guys are laughing too. This is ridiculous. Oh God, I'm probably just getting annoying now. This is where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups. This is where you can connect with other really cool shit shows who don't sound like this. Can you just do the damn thing? Don't you feel sorry for me? I need you to join so I can get my voice back, okay? See the show notes for a link to join to the community. Next, give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at AdultChildPod. And last but not least, give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Can I get a sympathy 5-star? Folks, come on, help a gal out. Love you, thanks. I'll see you soon.
All right, y'all, we're in for a damn treat. We have Krista St. Germain. The saint is not silent.
It is not.
Since my voice is limited and she's going to help me out as much as possible, she's going to give us the full rundown intro for us all.
Totally.
Oh, and just so you know, first, it's Andrea, and that's the only way that you can screw up here, is if you call me Andrea.
Call you Andrea or Andrea.
Done. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Andrea it is. Yes. I got it. Okay. So yes, I'm Krista Saint Germain. My husband was French Canadian, so he said it, and French was his first language, so he said it much more beautifully than I, as an American, say it. But so I'm a master certified life coach. I am obsessed with grief. I mainly spend my days coaching widowed moms, and I kind of came to this work because life threw me the curveball at about 40. I had been married for a long time, had two kids, got divorced, went down in flames, you know, the midlife experience, and then met Hugo, who was kind of like my redemption story. And we had just gotten married and we were on such a high. Everything was looking up. I was just like loving my life. And we went on a trip and we drove separately. It was about an hour away from where we live. And on the way back, I had a flat tire. And so I pulled over onto the side of the road. And even though we had AAA and I could have insisted that we call, right, and let them change the tire, he was like, no, I'll do it. It won't take me very long. I just want to be home. Let me just do it. So he's in between his car and my car on the side of the highway, hazard lights on, trying to get access to the spare tire. It's 5:30 on a Sunday, daylight, but the driver did not see us, did not see the hazard lights. He had meth and alcohol in his system, we found out later, and he just crashed right into the back of Hugo's Durango and trapped him in between his car and mine. And like the future I thought I was going to have and the life I thought I was going to have just whoosh, like ripped right out from under me within that very short period of time. It was less than a day. We did make it to the hospital, and there's more to that story. But essentially what I found out pretty quickly is that even though I had a really good therapist in my back pocket, because she had helped me with my divorce and I went right back to her, everything I thought I knew about grief was actually not, it was not either accurate or it wasn't helpful. And I got to a place where I now call it a grief plateau, where I was back to functioning. And everybody was telling me how strong I was. And I understand why they were saying that, because I probably did look great compared to how one might think you would be doing. But on the inside, I was really not feeling good at all. You know, I really was believing that I probably would never be truly happy again and that I had had my one shot. And now knowing what I know and being, you know, years out from that and having done a lot of work on it, I cannot stand the idea that people settle there, right? And use that phrase new normal as though they can't be happy after trauma. It's just not true. And so that's one of the reasons that I do what I do. And plus, when you go through something like that, you just realize, oh, life is way shorter than I thought. Like, am I doing what I want to be doing? And the answer for me was no, I'm not. And so I made a change. And so now that's what I do, is I work specifically with widows, and I host a podcast called the Widowed Mom Podcast. And I want to talk to people about grief, and I want to prepare them for it. And I want them to have a different experience than I did.
What was your experience in, because you mentioned you had a great therapist in your back pocket. What was your experience in grieving your first marriage? What did that process look like?
That process was long and drawn out as I look back on it. I'm glad I went through it. But dang, it was really hard for me to come to the conclusion to get a divorce.
Mm. How long were you married?
12, 13 years, 14 years. Mm-hmm. Apparently I'm trying to block it out. So yeah, Marissa was 12 when Hugo died and I was 25 and so 14 years.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So a lot, I mean, long enough, right? Right out of college, went to college. Graduated in May, married in June. Boom, 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 boom. So I went through a lot of like, you made your bed, you need to lie in it kinds of thinking, right? A lot of you need to stay in this for the kids. That's your, you know, it's selfish to want what you want and let yourself have it. And then eventually I got to a point where it was kind of like a switch flipped and I was like, done. I was like, put a fork in me, I'm done. And then after that, there was this combination of relief and grief, where it was like relieving to have made a decision. And then also there was so much grief in accepting that it hadn't worked out and allowing myself to feel sad about it and acknowledging that I could have made that decision so much sooner and that I really didn't have to wait for as long as I did and for it to be as long and drawn out as it was. So there were a lot of emotions, a lot of lessons learned. I have a lot of compassion for that version of me.
Yeah. I mean, was it just, I mean, obviously you were so damn young, right?
Oh, so
really
young.
Just an experience of like you just not really knowing yourself yet? Or do you feel like there were things perhaps that you overlooked or like red flags or when you reflect back on that marriage?
I don't think
either.
I hate to make blanket statements, but does anybody know themselves at 2021? No. I mean, it wasn't that I was completely oblivious to what I wanted. I just think I had really bought into you go to school, you get married, you have kids, that's your measure of success, kind of like that's what you're supposed to do. Yeah, and no insult. Like, this is a person I am actively co-parenting with and I love him dearly, right? So like, I don't want to trash talk, but there were a lot of things that made us very different and what we wanted was very different. And I think in my 20s, I was willing to say I wanted things I didn't want, right? And I don't think I was willing to allow someone else to be disappointed. Right. I put a lot of pressure on myself to make other people happy. And as we know well, that's a recipe for misery and disaster, and it doesn't really work. So, but it was what it was. And I got two beautiful kids out of it. So,
yeah.
But it definitely informed the way that I went about the second relationship.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting what you said, which is such common thinking as far as, you know, it's selfish of me to want to leave this marriage. But I think what we often overlook, and probably what is the most important thing, is like, it's really fucked up to make kids grow up in a home where mm-hmm. their parents don't really love each other, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, that's all the subtle messages. It's like, so many people are just so oblivious to like really what the true impact of it is. Like, you're not doing your kids any fucking favors, you know? Like, you can think that, oh, you're fighting behind closed doors, but it's all subtle. It's all energy. Kids pick up on all of that shit, you know?
Yeah. And I think you're totally right. And I also realized I wanted my daughter to see what it is like as a woman to put your own happiness really high on the priority list. Right. And that's not an easy thing to do, but that we're worth that. Mm-hmm. Right. I think I'm an empathetic person, and sometimes it's easy to confuse or conflate understanding someone. Like, I understood why he was the way that he was, and I couldn't fault him for why he was the way that he was. But what it also didn't mean was that I had to stay with that, mm-hmm. right? Just because I understood it and like got it doesn't mean I wanted to keep living it.
Yeah.
And yeah, also just don't think I was brought up to put myself first in that way. Not that anybody ever explicitly said don't, but somehow the message I got was, yeah, you make it work.
Yeah.
And also my parents had been divorced.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So my parents were divorced and remarried. In fact, my parents divorced. See if you can follow this, podcast listeners. My parents got married, had me divorced. My stepmom and stepdad got married, had my brother and divorced. And then over the period of a couple of years, my mom married my stepdad and my dad married my stepmom. So my stepbrother, his parents were my stepparents and my parents were his stepparents. So we grew up together at a very young age, switching, you know, houses once a week, every week, but always together. So we'd spend 1 week with my mom and his dad, 1 week with his mom and my dad. I know, right?
Were they good friends?
Well, they weren't in the beginning. They weren't in the beginning, but we couldn't tell. They did such a great job.
But were they family friends beforehand? Like,
oh, my mom and my stepmom were best friends in high school.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. They grew up together.
So when you did finally make that decision to get a divorce, what did conversations with their kids sound like?
Well, it was a pretty quick decision. You know, by the time I actually made it, like I said, it was like a switch flipped and I was like, and we're done. So really, you know, the conversation was, this is what's happening. And by the time I told them, like I had my parents take them for the weekend. I told him, we found him a place and we got him moved out. So the kids didn't even know it was happening until I had he was like, we had a place and we were moving. Mm-hmm. He was moving. So it was not pretty.
No. And so then how long after the divorce did you meet Hugo?
Well, I had already known him because we had worked together for a number of years, but we got married 2 years later.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then how long after that was the accident?
Oh, he like months. We got married in April. He died in August 1st.
And so what were those first few days like? A nightmare? It seemed real, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, it's just a giant blur. Like, I remember bits from the hospital, and I remember telling the kids, and I remember coming home, and I remember being in bed and, you know, my family being around. But honestly, it's just a complete blur. His family lived in Canada, and so they, like, came in immediately. So I remember my stepmom and my aunt coming over to my house and like trying to help me clean and get ready and, you know, flowers starting to show up and, you know, people starting to bring food, but it's a big blur.
Did he have children?
Yeah. 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 Marissa was 12 at the time and Cleo was 9.
No, did he?
Oh, he didn't have a biological child, but Lance, he would say was his child. He had Lance in his life since Lance's mom, I mean, he was in diapers when he met Lance, and Lance's dad left his mom when his mom was pregnant, like stole all her stuff and left as she was pregnant. So bio dad was never around, and Hugo was really the only dad that Lance had. So, but he wasn't his biological dad, but he considered him his kid. Yeah.
So why don't you just kind of like outline, like, what did it look like initially? What did life look like? Like, what were the, you know, kind of like the pivotal points as far as coming out of this, you know, because I know it looks different for everyone, but, you know, what were kind of like the significant phases of, you know, let's just say like the first, I don't know, 6 months.
Yeah. Regular appointments with a therapist to just talk about it to someone who didn't have an opinion and who I felt like I wasn't burdening. Really, really helpful, right? A lot of journaling, a lot of sitting on my back porch and trying to ground myself with my feet on the concrete and, you know, journaling to him and just like trying to let myself catch up. The knowledge that he was gone and wasn't coming back makes sense. You know it, but your brain, this is what I've learned since then. You intellectually know what happened, but your brain is so used to predicting that it should be the way that it was, that your brain needs time to update so that it makes accurate predictions. And so that's what it was. It was that dissonance between I intellectually knew it had happened, but my brain kept still telling me he was on a business trip and the garage door would open and it would be him, or you go to pick up the phone and you're going to text him, you know? So it was a lot of that just weirdness. I went back to work at probably 6-ish weeks, which actually felt a little bit like a relief in some ways. Some ways, yes, and some ways, no, because we worked together. So everyone knew him, and he had worked there for 20 years. I'd only been there for not quite 10. So some people knew him longer than they had known me, which actually felt good, right, in some ways, because I didn't feel so alone, but also some ways awkward because people kind of handled me with kid gloves a little bit. You know, they were afraid to talk about it or afraid to bring it up or afraid to make me sad. And I actually wanted to talk about it. So I would have to do it and bring it up. It was also kind of an unstable time where I worked. And so I was a little bit nervous about not being at work. You know, I was a little bit nervous that if I wasn't there, that my job would be irrelevant or they would see that they could do without me. And I had some of those fears and I kind of wanted to go back for that reason. And then you're like, now I'm single income again. Yeah, I better make sure that this is stable. And then kind of over that fall, just starting to realize, I don't think this is what I want to do anymore. I don't know what I want to do, but I don't think this is it.
What were you doing?
You don't mind me saying. I was managing a team of project engineers for a company, Bombardier Learjet, where basically we would do expensive upgrades and remodels or resolve safety issues on airplanes. Nothing that I cared about, right? In terms of, I loved the people and I loved solving problems and I loved challenging projects, but Hugo was an engineer by trade. He loved planes, right? A plane would fly over and he's looking up at the sky and he's just fascinated by them. And that was his thing. For me, it was a job. It was just money. And I happen to like the people. So then I started going, I don't think this is where I want to be forever. And then trying to figure that out, right? Of like, all right, what do I want to do if this isn't it?
Yeah, I can really relate to that. Like, you know, I hit my adult child bottom. I was 9 years sober at the time, where I really came to terms with how much my childhood really did impact me. Mm-hmm. A large part of that realization was how much I had been selling myself short from a career perspective. Let me take this call. Mm. You know, I was a CPA at the time, you know, and it was just like,
yeah,
realizing like, I don't give a shit about this. It was also like, I'm kind of letting my potential go to waste. Oh. I know that there's great things about me. And so it was like, not only embarking on this journey to like heal from my childhood, but on embarking on this journey to figure out why the fuck was I put here, you know?
Yeah.
And it led me to starting this podcast, just like, mm-hmm. It led you to doing the work that you're doing too, you know?
Yeah.
So, and we'll get into that more post-traumatic growth stuff in a bit. That's what it is. It's like, it's through this stuff that I really feel like we get to actually live our lives, like become the person that we're supposed to be, you know?
100%.
Push off the ledge.
Yeah. And it's just like this, for me, it was like this kind of gnawing too of like, okay. I mean, I knew people had died before. It wasn't that I hadn't experienced death before. It wasn't like the first time. But this time, it felt more of a wake-up call than when other people had died, right? It was like, okay, if it really is this short, if it really is this precarious, am I spending my days the way that I want to spend them? Am I making the difference that I want to make? And the answer was just no. And then I had to figure out, okay, well then, like, what are my other options? And I started taking like career assessments and like Strength Finder and like, you know, talking with my therapist about it. Yeah. 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 So.
And my experience was like, it really was led, you know, and it was just kind of like God putting different people in my path to kind of show me like, hey, this is your gift. I'm curious if it was something similar as you.
Yes. There feels like there's like divine timing involved. Mm-hmm. So like, my therapist was telling me I should be a therapist and she would help me get into an MFT program. And when, you know, I could come and work in her practice because she ran a practice where there were lots of other clinicians and I could come and work in her practice. And then when she retired, I could buy her practice. Like, she had seen the clear path for me. And that felt kind of right, because I bet you probably relate to it too, right? Where you've just kind of always been the person that people come to and want to talk about their problems with. Like, even if you don't have those same problems, like, they just feel safe with you and they want to come and talk to you. And that's kind of always the role that I was in really any job I ever had. So I could see that in myself, to the point where I actually did go ahead and enroll in an MFT program. And then I had been listening to this podcast from a life coach who at that point in time had not sold anything that was of interest to me. Like, she sold life coaching certification and she sold higher end weight loss, and that stuff wasn't interesting to me. But then she happened to launch a program that was like general stuff. And I was like, okay, I'm going to give this a shot. Maybe this will be, I'll learn some stuff about myself. Maybe this will help me. And it wasn't very long into that where I went, oh, okay, here's some tools that this is tripping my trigger, right? Like, I like this. And then it became, over the next 9 months, kind of this decision of therapy versus life coaching. And ultimately I was like, I'm going to go the life coaching route, which was a really scary thing to do because, first of all, I live in Kansas.
For your own healing or for you professionally?
Well, I think it was it was definitely for me, for sure. But then also it became professionally, right? Yeah. So I was fully planning on going through an MFT program and within 2 years becoming a therapist and quitting my job. And that was going to be my thing. And I was going to work full time and go to therapy, you know, MFT, and get that all done and get a license and become a therapist. But then as I was going through the process and enrolled in the school and got accepted and went through orientation and learned more about it, I was also having this experience with coaching, and ultimately coaching won out. Not only did it win out, it won out for me as my preferred
Modality of healing.
Yeah, great way to say it. And because of that, it became what I decided to do. I was not at the time thinking I was going to do grief work, however, but I had decided, okay, I think life coaching is what I want to do. And then I ended up getting certified and quitting my job and yada, yada.
I'm curious, when, you know, you deciding that the coaching was the route for you, and this is something that I talk about a lot on this podcast, I'm curious if a large reason for that was because of the amount of which the coach was willing to get open and vulnerable with you about their shit, right? Because, like, I think that that's one thing that in a lot of, you know, therapy relationship, if a therapist is very tight-lipped and they don't want to open up to you know, themselves, like talk a lot about their experience. Like, I know for me, the times that like therapy is most beneficial to me is like when the therapist is willing to get raw and vulnerable and connect their own personal experience to whatever it is, you know, that I'm going through. And that really creates a therapeutic relationship is most beneficial, I think, when there really is that true, authentic connection.
100% agree. And I think also for me, I think I was still in kind of a proving energy where I was kind of trying to prove to myself that I was okay. And so I think I was trying to prove it to her too.
You think there was some people pleasing?
Yeah, totally. And I don't think she was calling me on it. I'm not sure if she recognized it, but if she did, she wasn't calling me on it. And I also think because of that people pleasing and like proving energy, I don't think I was articulating the extent to which I was worried about the future and, you know, and how I was feeling. I think I was just kind of like, I've got this, I can do this. Like, you know, so it's quite possible that had I been more honest, or had she, I don't know, you know, had something been different, it's possible that maybe she had access to some of the same tools that I went on and found in life coaching and loved. I don't know. I don't blame her at all for like any shortcomings, but there was something about that I was missing in terms of how to relate to my feelings, like how to, I didn't have really tools to like allow them and process them. And I didn't understand that so much of what I was thinking was optional. That was news to me. That
expand upon that.
Well, like I was really just believing, but never really saying, yeah, my best days are probably behind me. Like I should just be happy for what I had. At least I knew what love looked like. At least I had a taste of it, you know, and thinking that that was the truth and not really seeing that was a story I didn't have to tell myself if I didn't want to. And my therapist may have never had a chance to point it out to me because I'm not sure I articulated it to her. But when I started using the tools that I was learning in life coaching, it became very clear, right, that those were optional stories in my brain and that I could actually change them. And that's when I think I started getting more traction and started seeing, oh, shit. Of course, this is what I'm thinking. And also, I don't have to keep doing this to myself. There are other options available. But that took like being coached, that took becoming a coach, that took getting coached after becoming a coach. Like it was not a quick thing. It was a lot of digging in there.
Well, it's like shame in a way, you know? I think that some of those thoughts are rooted in shame. And like when we keep them in our head, it just allows them to like fester, you know, and grow. And it's like when we share them with somebody else, true healing occurs through, you know, like authentic connection and acceptance of whatever it is that we're feeling and thinking, you know?
Yeah. And I think to your point, had I known at the time that what I was thinking didn't mean anything about me as the human, there wouldn't have been a reticence to share it.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah. And it, but it took me a long time to learn that.
So talk about what you meant by you realized that everything that you thought you knew about grief turned out like not to be to be accurate.
Yeah.
And what did that unfolding process look like for you?
Okay. So, well, first of all, the only thing I really had ever heard in terms of grief theory or like what you're supposed to experience when grief happens was the 5 stages of grief. And so I was coming at it from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, should say Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and David Kessler wrote the Death and Dying book initially in 1969. So 1969, can we just start there, right? That's it's been a minute and really important work in its day because people weren't talking about it so much, but also it was anecdotal in that what Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was writing about was what she was noticing in patients who were coming to terms with their own death. right? They were hospice patients coming to terms with their own mortality. And so she wasn't ever intending to say it's supposed to look like denial and anger and bargaining and depression and acceptance. She was noticing that a lot of people were experiencing those things. And so On Death and Dying was written. And then those five stages were then used in On Grief and Grieving. And so people took that work in a way that I don't think, and she wrote about it later in life, like that she didn't mean for people to make it formulaic or stage-based or to say that anything outside of these five different things was wrong, right, or bad. She didn't even really mean to say that grief ends, right? Mm. But that's how we took it. And that's where it caught on in our popular culture and in our lexicon. And that's, people are still saying it, right? And still comparing it. And it's such a different experience for every single human. And it's so, but it's so familiarly frustrating to every single human when you try to compare what you're experiencing to some sort of boxy, linear, mm-hmm. blah. It's awful. So you're asking yourself questions like, well, am I angry enough? Did I get too angry? Is this the part where I'm in denial? What's, you know, is acceptance a place that I reach? Like, when is the end? And it's all just misinformed, but it makes so much sense why we end up there, right? I also had no idea what grief fog was, did not know that was a thing, did not know that was normal. In my mind, grief was going to be about emotions. I did not understand how much of a full body experience it is, right? I did not know about the sleeplessness and the hormone fluctuations and that you were going to feel like a hot mess and your memory was going to be awful. And I was a big reader, so not being able to read and retain information was super frustrating to me. So yeah, there's just a lot that I didn't know. And also then throw in my, at the time, get the A personality, right? Like all the gold stars, I'm going to get them, right? We're going to do grief right. Guess what? Can't do it wrong. There is no way to do it right. A little uncomfortable because at the time I wanted somebody to say, here's how you do it. Here's how it's done. When you're feeling so powerless, you want structure. But grief doesn't have that. Like people want to be like, well, what do you do? What are the stages? What do you recommend? Well, I know why we want that. And also, wouldn't it be nice if we had it? But it's not the way that it works. Yeah. So yeah, there was a lot of misinformation, lack of information, and then a desire to do it right that did not help.
About, and I'm not sure if this is something that you experienced, but I know one thing that's common is, you know, if we have repressed grief, you know, when we experience a loss like that, like not only are we experiencing, you know, what's happening in the present, it's also bringing up all of that hurt and that loss that mm-hmm. we have yet to process from our past, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Cumulative grief, right? It's a thing. I mean, we can look at it, we can normalize it for what it is and say that that can be a real big surprise and it can feel like a double or a triple whammy, but also it can be a great opportunity to be like, oh, okay, here's some stuff I haven't yet processed and gotten support around. So maybe now's the time. Maybe it's not something that I want to continue to ignore because ignoring it is not getting me where I want to go. And I think that's what I do wish people would understand more, that, you know, this is not an experience that you want to white knuckle your way through.
Mm.
And if you go into it with the myth that time is going to do all the work,
yeah,
right? And all you have to do is like just get through the first year, just get through the whatever, then of course you're not going to figure out how to support yourself. You're not going to figure out how to allow yourself to feel. You're going to just grip down, hold on, hang tight. And then you're going to wake up at a certain point and you're going to be like, oh shit, it's not any better. Time passed. And yet I still don't feel like I want to feel. But I mean, who hasn't heard that time heals all wounds?
Mm-hmm. What about parenting? Like during that first mm-hmm. year, like the guilt, like what was that experience like?
Yeah, I was on like hyper alert. I think it was mm-hmm. like a combination of being sometimes so absorbed in your own stuff that you can't even see beyond it. And then also really being simultaneously very worried that your kids aren't going to have what they need. I took them to a therapist, the therapist that I had taken them to when their dad and I got divorced. So they went back to their therapist and their therapist was like, no, they seem to be doing great. You know, I think a lot of it didn't come a lot of the things that they struggled with didn't come to light until years later. Some of them are still, they're still coming up. Both kids handled it very differently. For my youngest, it was like the realization that people die. It was the first person that he had ever lost. And so he was very worried that I would die. And mommy, I just, if you die, I want to die only a few seconds later because I don't want to have to be without you. Like that was his deal, right? And then my daughter who was 12, for her, it was more, she realized the impact of losing him, right? Of what she had lost because he wasn't there. Whereas I don't think that's what my youngest was dealing with. Yeah. I'm really glad I had tapping at that point. I did have that tool and I did tap a lot, especially with my youngest. That made bedtimes a lot easier. But yeah, it was, you don't know. You just don't know if you're doing the right thing, right? That you want so badly to do the right thing, but it's just not that simple.
Mm-hmm. Okay. A lot of, and I don't know if this is something you can touch upon and you know anything about, something that I can relate to, a lot of my listeners can relate to, is that a lot of us are grieving our parents while they're still alive.
Yeah.
Do you have anything to say?
So, yeah. So there's so many different kinds of grief, right? And I think there can be such power in just naming, just knowing that the kind of grief you're experiencing is not just you. Like there are names for these things, right? So for instance, you know, anticipatory loss, right? So like let's say we've got, you know, somebody with a terminal illness, right? And you know that they're dying, you're losing them. You're anticipating the loss as it's happening, right? That's a thing. Knowing that secondary loss exists, right? So there's the primary loss, and then there's all the losses afterwards. And that doesn't just mean bereavement, right? So maybe when you think about your parents, you think about how they're still living, but maybe your relationship with them is not at all what you thought it was going to be. Or ever was. Yeah. And maybe let's zoom out first, because I think we didn't really talk about this and I think it matters. So I define grief as the natural human response to a perceived loss. And so when we think about just the perceived loss part of it, that expands grief a lot, right? Because there are so many different losses that you might perceive, that I might perceive. What might feel like a loss to me might not feel like a loss to you, but that doesn't make it less of a loss. So if you imagined your parent would be one way and they turned out to be another, that is a loss. And then every other thing you imagined that you would have if your parent were the way you thought they were supposed to be, but you don't now have, is a secondary loss. And that's like the death by a thousand paper cuts. There's the initial loss of realizing that they aren't who you wanted them to be. Mm-hmm. And then there's every moment in the future that you don't even really anticipate and can't yet because it hasn't necessarily happened, where if they were who you thought they would be, it would play out differently than it actually does. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's kind of almost easier sometimes to think about it in terms of bereavement, because it's easier to imagine, well, I thought that person would physically be there and they're not. Like my daughter's wedding, I thought Hugo would be there. Well, he's not going to be if she gets married. Right. I thought we were going to retire and now we're not going to be, but it still happens with people who are living too, because you thought it would be one way and maybe they're still physically here, but it's not the way you wanted it to be. And that's like loss after loss after loss after loss.
And it's almost harder to grieve that shit because people don't even realize that it's grief.
100%. And that's why putting a name to it, I think just even if that's all we do, putting a name to it helps. It normalizes it. Like it's not a you thing. It's not a you problem. It's not even a problem.
You think it's a good way to suss that out? Like, how does, like, I know you gave me a definition, you know, but like, is there a question like that somebody could ask themselves that would be like, oh, okay, then this is grief. Like, gee,
is it a situation where I thought it was going to go one way and it went another? And the feeling that I have feels like loss. It's so many things.
Yeah.
And we thought it would go this way. It went that way. Loss.
Friendship. So many things.
I mean, yes. And so it's multiple times in a day sometimes too, yeah. Right? It's like even you're in a relationship and it's going really well, but you thought a person would have a particular characteristic and you realize they don't. And you're still in the relationship and you still love them very much. And also there's loss in that. Yeah. So to me, it is, can I allow myself to feel how I feel? Right. Not tell myself I'm wrong for feeling how I feel, because that's what I would have been inclined to do before. And that's what I see a lot of us are doing. Uh-huh. So we're like, well, undesirable emotions are bad because happiness is the point. So if I feel anything other than happy, it's a problem I have to solve. And so, of course, it's probably my fault. Right. That there enters shame, enter judgment, not letting ourselves actually feel how we feel. Ugh, what a different world it would be if we just let ourselves feel how we feel without judging ourselves for it. And then we can decide, okay, now what, right? It didn't go the way that I wanted. It isn't going the way that I wanted. I've let myself feel how I feel about it. Okay, now what do I want? Now who do I want to be? And sometimes it's a matter of, do I want to keep, not that I'm wrong for doing it, but do I want to keep telling myself it should be some other way than it is?
Mm. It's really fucking hard to let that go.
Boy, howdy. And I don't even know that it's like, when I say it, I don't want people to hear me saying, you should let it be the way that it is. I'm not saying that. But I think it's something we want to ask ourselves so that we have the ability to exercise some agency in, you know, I do want to continue to tell myself it shouldn't be this way, or I don't. And I've made that decision consciously.
Yeah, this is really pertinent for me. You know, I'm just kind of lost a friendship that I really wasn't expecting to go the way that it is. And God, it's hard, you know?
Yeah.
What about like from a somatic release perspective? I mean, like, what is that? You talked about tapping, but like, what did like releasing the grief stored in your body look like?
Tapping has by far been the most helpful thing for me, but yoga, sometimes even still, stuff comes out in yoga where I'm like, wow, I didn't even know I was holding that. And all of a sudden I'm, you know, crying or shaking or, you know, whatever. I don't know that it's, you know, I don't think it matters what the modality is as much as it's that we give ourselves permission to let it out, right? To like figure out what we need to do to help ourselves. But those are the two things that have probably helped me the most. But I'm a tapping demon. Like I tap all the time.
Yeah. Do you know who the fuck is his name? I had on like Mr. Tap Brad. What the fuck is his
name? Brad Yates.
Yeah. I had him on.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I think there's so many things. Breathe. You know, there's so many different breathing techniques. That's not really something I have studied or gotten into.
A clown.
What? Brad was a clown?
Clown initially. Yeah.
Was no, clown. I did not know
he was
that.
In clown school.
That's so not what I expected.
Yeah. It's a clown school.
That's fantastic. Who would have thought?
Oh, good. So talk about like learning about post-traumatic growth and just go from there.
Yeah. So I had never heard the term before. I knew what post-traumatic stress disorder was, but I didn't know anything about post-traumatic growth. So
were you experiencing like PTSD like symptoms afterwards?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I never got a diagnosis. Well, what it looked like for me was sounds of metal crashing, right? Would take me right back to the accident. CPR scenes, woof, right. I was right back there. Anytime I saw like a car on the side of the road or someone trying to change a tire, like just seeing a Durango around town, just driving, just seeing the front of a Durango because I had such visions of what happened in the accident. Those were all things that would just send my nervous system right back to the accident. So it was racing heart, you know, I intellectually understood I was safe, but yeah, my body was not responding.
Did you do any like EMDR or anything specific?
I had tried EMDR before for something else and I didn't love it. Uh-huh. What helped me was tapping.
Okay.
Yeah. So just gradually going back and while I'm tapping with the help of someone, not doing it on my own, although I did it on my own a lot. Like I remember one time I was driving under a bridge and right as the time I drove under the bridge, a car came across the top of the bridge and like hit like a seam in the road and it just made this really loud noise. And so I'm driving, but I had enough knowledge, like enough habit to like start tapping on my collarbone and be like, okay. So I was able to use it to support myself and calm myself in moments, but working with an actual practitioner helped me go back and neutralize some of the actual memories so that scenes are less, I'm in the present moment more when those things happen as opposed to in the past. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm sorry I derailed you from post-traumatic
growth. No, totally fine. So post-traumatic growth, yeah, I just remember learning about it and thinking, what is that? Why is people not talking about that? And then I was really surprised to learn that a lot of, like, some of the initial work in post-traumatic growth was done on widows, go figure. So the idea being that, you know, in the mid-90s, before the phrase was coined, post-traumatic growth, the idea was that when somebody went through something traumatic, you know, they would experience a decrease in wellness or quality of life. And the best you could hope for was to get them back to the level of wellness or quality of life that they experienced before the traumatic event. And at that time, traumatic was more like big T, little T, mm-hmm. objective trauma, right? Like yeah. not what we understand now, which is that it's highly subjective. Mm-hmm. But it was like, all right, you're either going to dip down and stay there, or you're going to dip down and bounce back. And then post-traumatic growth says, no, actually, you don't have to stay down. And you don't just have to bounce back. You can actually bounce forward, not in spite of your event, your traumatic event, but because of what you decide to do with it. And I think in the beginning, it was like an interesting concept that piqued my curiosity and also a little bit repulsive, right? Like a little bit like, oh, so I'm going to go. So because my husband died, I'm going to be happier. Like, here's a big F you to that. Right. So, which I think most people go through, because you make it mean something it doesn't have to mean, right? You make it mean, well, if I'm quote unquote happier, that means I asked for it, or that means I wanted it to happen, or that means I didn't really love them, or none of that is actually true. But that was the journey for me, was figuring out that that wasn't actually the case, that it really just was, okay, we go through stuff in life, and at all points, we get to be the ones who decide what we want to make of that stuff. And we get to use all the things that we go through as ways to realign ourselves with what we really value, with what really matters to us, and make choices accordingly. So if we don't want to if we've been people pleasing and we don't want to do that anymore, then we can change. Like, we can get out of those relationships, or we can show up differently in those relationships. If we don't like the career that we have, we can change it. If we have been buying into some sort of faith tradition that we didn't choose for ourselves, we can re-choose.
Yeah. And I think that for a lot of us, we think that, like, it's all kind of stages or linear in a way, in the sense it's like, okay, like, first I got to get over this and then I can start building, you know, when it's really just a process that is always, it's intertwined and it's all mm-hmm. going together. Yeah. So can you talk about that too? Like, I'm sure it was, you know, it's healing, it's grieving, it's growing, it's all mm-hmm. happening at the same fucking time.
Yeah. And it sounds pretty, right? When you say it, post-traumatic growth, it sounds like it's going to be pretty and fun and right. Like, it's good. Yeah. And it's not that way at all, because to your point, there's like all the stuff you're dealing with to integrate what has even happened with whatever the traumatic event was. And then there's, what do I want to make of it? And then for many people, there's guilt and there's shame and there's deep sadness and there's powerlessness. And then there's, and then you kind of realize that you actually can do something about it. And then you feel grief for having not done something about it sooner. And it's like this really messy, icky awfulness that can be ultimately, you know, can ultimately help us live into even more of what we want, but that really doesn't feel great in the process mm-hmm. at all. Maybe there are glimmers of good feelings. I don't want to say that it's all doomsday, but I do think that, like, the metaphor of, like, the butterfly becoming the, bleh, you know, like, there's some truth to that where you just kind of, you go through it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's been times of, like, hitting, like, subsequent bottoms, or where you think, like, you're like, all right, I'm doing good, you know, and then something else comes up, something else that you... And what I've noticed for myself is, like, it's like, as we heal and grow and cultivate more resilience, it's like our subconscious then knows, like, okay, you're ready to go a little bit deeper now, you know, like, you can handle this. Now it's time to bring this shit up. It's fucking wacky.
Yeah. And that's how, like, I've experienced it too, is it almost feels like, you describe it as a bottom. To me, it almost feels like a top. It almost feels like a ceiling, where, like, I'll get myself to a place where it's more of what I want. And then that's when it gets ugly again, where I'm like, oh, you know, the upper limit stuff comes up. The worthiness stuff comes up. Is it getting too good? Is it going to all be taken away from me? Can it really be this good? Am I allowed to have it be this good? Are people still going to love me if it's this good? Like, it's the same shit, but it comes because of the growth. And it feels like a top to me, like a ceiling. It's the weirdest thing, but it's like also the best thing. And then I realized, and so my realization, and of course I have to keep relearning it, is that is just what happens when we hit a growth edge, right? And we get comfortable with where we are and we make peace with whatever it is and we do the work in advance to whatever the next belief is that we have about ourselves or the things that we want to create. And then we have an urge to go a little further and then it gets uncomfortable again. And then all the same ick and fear and doubt and whatever comes up. And that doesn't mean we're doing it wrong. It just means that's what growth is. And then we get comfortable there and then we do it all again. And it's just like this constant expansion that doesn't always feel good mm-hmm. in the expanding.
Yeah. I'm curious for you. I talk about this with my therapist. Like, you know, I think there's certain things that we can work through. And I think that there's other things, there's certain themes, whatever it might be, that will continue to rear their ugly head throughout our lives, mm-hmm. you know, like, mm-hmm. and kind of coming to that place of acceptance of like, okay, yeah. like, this is going to be something that this is going to be yeah. a thing for me, you know, yeah. like, okay, oh, here that is again. Have yeah. you had something like that happen? Like, is there a particular limiting belief or something that, you know, continues to kind of to show itself every now and then?
I think there's quite a few like similarities and where I'm like, oh yeah, this is the part where, and so like one of them is I have this part of me, I call it the clipboard carrier. The clipboard carrier would very much like things to be predictable and stable and math based, right? The clipboard carrier would like my business to be reliable and consistent and we would like everything to make sense, but it doesn't always make sense, right? And so when I grow or when something happens, it is very normal for me to then have to like acknowledge that the clipboard carrier is having a little bit of a freak out and like normalize that and comfort that part of myself, right? And figure out, okay, how do I create safety here? How do I remind myself that I am safe? And just accepting all of that all of those parts of me are there and that they will always have their way has been very helpful to me, as opposed to like trying to change all of those parts of me, right? It's just, no, this is the part where that part of me decides that something has gone wrong. Okay, we know this. Mm-hmm. But it's not a wrong thing or a bad thing. Where did it come from? Who knows? Do I need to know? I don't know. But when it shows up, I'm like, oh yeah, I know this one. I know this one. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it takes a while. It takes a while before I really know it, right? Like I have to spin out a little bit first and feel scared first and then come back and like, okay, yeah. That's what it is.
Similarities or differences have you noticed with widowed dads?
I don't think widowed dads are getting the love. Well, interestingly, statistically speaking, widowed dads get back into relationships much, much faster than widowed moms. Like they don't stay single for nearly as long. I'm not going to say there's no support out there because I know that there is support, but I think they're much more likely to go it alone than widowed moms are. There are less communities available and I think they are less about seeking community. But I think a lot of the emotional struggles are still the same.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So yeah, I do wish it's always heartbreaking to me because I do get a lot of emails from men saying, hey, you know,
help a guy out.
What is there for, yeah, like what is there for men? And I'm like, it's not, you know, it's not what I offer. And I wish so that I could be like, here's the person you know, can go to or the community that I see that, yeah.
Gentlemen so listening right now, a huge opportunity here.
Huge opportunity. Yeah. And it's not that I think women couldn't be helpful, but I think it's better when it's a, you know, somebody who has the same lived experience, which I don't
have. 100%. 100%. So tell them all the ways they can work with you and everything that you do.
Yeah. So if anybody's listening and you're just interested in grief, you can come listen to my podcast. I realize it is very specific sounding because it's called the Widowed Mom Podcast. And a lot of people are like, not a widowed mom, not for me. But honestly, if you're just interested in grief or you're interested in post-traumatic growth, like for sure, they can come and listen. As for who I work with, I really only work with widows. And I do that inside of a group container. But coaching with Krista is where people can find me. Also, I do actually do, I don't even know why I don't think about this, grief education. So if somebody wants me to come in, sometimes I'll go into organizations and help them kind of expand their understanding of grief and figure out how to better support the people that they serve who might be experiencing grief. So I love doing that too.
Amazing. Well, I'll include everything in the show notes. You need to come up with a workbook, lady.
Well, I got a lot for the people that are in my widow coaching program. Yeah, but sure, yeah, I do see my work expanding. I do see it.
When did you launch your business?
I've been coaching widows since 2018.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And pretty specific in that. But I do feel an expansion coming. No, I really don't get sick of it. I get totally jazzed by it. I that was one of the reasons I didn't think I initially wanted to do it is because I thought it would be too heavy.
Yeah.
But I find it's there's like no place I'd rather be. So the part that burns me out sometimes is the business side, not the coaching side. That's the business side is hard sometimes, but I love it. And yeah, I think eventually it'll turn into something that's a little more grief broad. And I also work with coaches who are certified in the style of coaching that I'm certified in and help.
What style is that?
Coaches. It's the Life Coach School. So they don't have to be certified by Life Coach School, but they need to be kind of familiar with the self-coaching model and some of the tools that particular style uses. And then it makes me sad that people are not comfortable coaching grief, right? Mm. I think a lot of people out there, because they aren't in their minds helping people who are in grief, but everybody's having it. So if they're helping people, in grief, right? And if they aren't comfortable around it, then there are a lot of people who aren't getting coaching that they really need because their coach is uncomfortable with it. And so I also help with that. But
this has been great. Thank you.
So great. You have such a lovely interview style. Like, I love how real you are.
Yeah. Only way you know how to be. Don't let it all go.